I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the U.S. weighs military options in light of a Syrian chemical weapons report. On the second anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death, are we safer? Israelis and Palestinians are cautious about the Arab League land swap stand.
This is accepting principle which was discussed before. It's been agreed now by the Arab countries. I think this is a good start, if it's not a breakthrough.
And world press freedoms are reported on the decline. It's all ahead. Pentagon planners have been putting together military options for the president to consider in dealing with Syria's chemical weapons. Analysts say none of those options is simple or straightforward, as they could involve the deployment of tens of thousands of troops, a high risk of contamination, and a likely large-scale escalation of the conflict. VOA Pentagon correspondent Luis Ramirez has this report for VOA Television.
The options being considered include bombing weapon sites and even the possibility of arming rebels. In any scenario, there are no easy or quick solutions, leading Defense Department officials to proceed with extreme caution. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says the U.S. has concluded with some degree of varying confidence that Syria has used chemical weapons, but cautions against any rash decisions.
We are continuing to assess what happened, when, where. I think we should wait to get the facts before we make any judgments on what action, if any, should be taken and what kind of action.
Just locating the chemical weapons would be a monumental operation that could involve the deployment of hundreds of U.S. troops who would be tasked with safeguarding the weapons and preventing contamination, a job for which they have already trained extensively in places like Iraq. Syria's air defenses remain strong, and analysts envision a powerful and fierce reaction from Bashar al-Assad's forces. Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute says it could be a messy operation.
We're not going to be able to simply secure the chemical weapons. That could take a couple weeks, and that's if the government were cooperating with us. So if we want to get rid of the chemical weapons, it literally means bombing them. That's going to spread a great deal of contamination.
Another approach would be to set up a safe haven involving the enforcement of no-fly zones that would require even more resources and participation from allies, making it an even more complicated option. With no consistent intelligence at this point, the choices remain unclear. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the Pentagon.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry travels to Russia next week for talks with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov and an expected meeting with President Vladimir Putin. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stern says the crisis in Syria is expected to be prominent in their discussions.
Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov have already met several times over the past few months, but this will be the Secretary of State's first trip to Moscow.
And the visit, in my judgment, is overdue. I look forward to that, and particularly given the range of issues that we need to discuss, from Syria to Iran to the upcoming G8 summit.
On Syria, the United States and Russia have been at odds over how best to deal with the rebellion there. Russia and China have repeatedly used their Security Council veto to block tougher United Nations action against embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia supplies weapons to the Assad army. The United States and other countries support his opponents, although Washington says it is not providing weapons. Acting Deputy State Department spokesman Patrick Ventrell.
We've been clear with the Russians where we've had disagreements and differences of opinion, and that includes the support and arms they've provided to the Syrian regime. We've been clear there are some issues like chemical weapons and others where we have mutual interests and mutual concerns.
Ventrell says the key point that Kerry will make in Moscow is the need for a political solution.
We still think that a political transition is the best way to end the violence. And to do so in the swiftest way to prevent further bloodshed and to maintain some of the Syrian institutions so that there's not a further devolution or a further dissolution of the institutions that provide basic services to the Syrian people.
Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Recently, the European Union lifted the embargo on oil coming from opposition-controlled areas in Syria. But there are doubts about how quickly the rebels will be able to start trading with the EU. Meanwhile, backyard refineries are springing up as impoverished Syrians try to make some money. Henry Ridgewell has details from London.
in his backyard north of the city of Idlib, Ahmed Abu Talib and his friend use hand pumps to transfer a barrel of crude oil into a tank. A fire burns in a pit dug below the tank. Then, drip by drip, through a simple system of pipes, the distilled products, fuel oil and diesel, empty into lined trenches nearby. Few of the workers are trained. No one wears protective gear, and the fires burn next to tanks full of fuel. Abu Talib says the risks are worth it. In 24 hours, he extracts 9 barrels of fuel. Abu Talib says he gets the crude oil from the freed areas or from oil wells freed by the Free Syrian Army. He says it's used to provide gasoline to areas that need it. The makeshift gas stations, he says, provide a lifeline for local residents who struggle to heat their homes. As the Syrian civil war has intensified, U.S. data indicates that oil production in the country more than halved between 2011 and 2012. That's mainly due to EU sanctions, says David Butter of London-based policy institute Chatham House.
The sanctions actually did stop production because foreign operators pulled out. Also, the Syrian government didn't really have anywhere to put the oil. It had limited capacity to put the oil through their refineries and then limited storage capacity when their export options were cut off.
In recent days, EU ministers lifted the embargo on oil coming from areas of Syria held by the opposition. The EU's foreign policy chief is Catherine Ashton.
3 types of transactions will now be possible. Imports of oil and petroleum products, exports of key equipment and technology for the oil and gas industry, and investments in the Syrian oil industry.
But David Butter of Chatham House says it will be a long time before the EU starts buying oil from the opposition.
Most of the oil is under the control of various other groups. Most notorious, of course, is Jabhat al-Nusra, which has an al-Qaeda connection, and many other groups. So there's no sense that they're centrally controlled by an opposition body with which companies in the EU could actually do business with.
Syria has denounced the EU's decision. Before the uprising, the IMF estimates oil exports accounted for a quarter of government revenue. Abid Mayaleh is governor of Syria's central bank. Mayaleh says he does not understand how the European Union can give what he calls armed terrorist groups the right to export oil to Europe. This is money laundering, he says. This is stolen money and these are stolen goods. As Syria's economy continues to suffer, primitive refineries are springing up in backyards across the country. A dangerous business, but a way to survive amid the conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The international aid charity Oxfam says the UN Security Council should use its influence to improve humanitarian access in Syria. Sayla Hennessy reports from London. The charity says the council should urge Syrian government and opposition groups to make sure aid is reaching civilians.
Oxfam's humanitarian coordinator for the Middle East, Pauline Balaman, spoke to VOA from neighboring Jordan. She says inside Syria, nearly 7 million people are in need of aid.
It's becoming critical that we can have access to those populations where they are and that humanitarian assistance can be provided to them.
The countries that neighbor Syria have been hit with an onslaught of refugees since the crisis began more than 2 years ago. An estimated 1.3 million Syrian refugees are living in neighboring countries and refugee camps are stretched to their limits. Earlier this month, UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, urged the Security Council to grant aid agencies cross-border access to Syria and pleaded for council members to take the action necessary to end this brutal conflict. The Security Council says the escalating violence is unacceptable and condemned the widespread violations of human rights by the Syrian authorities, as well as any human rights abuses by armed groups. Oxfam's Pauline Balaman said aid groups are raising the alarm over the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Syria and calling for more funding. But London-based analyst David Hartwell with IHS Jane's says international calls for increased humanitarian assistance for Syrians are falling on deaf ears.
The plight of civilians is currently of a lesser consideration, unfortunately, than the issues of power politics and terrorism.
Oxfam says 3 months after $1.5 billion was pledged by international donors for the United Nations to help Syrians, just more than half of the money has been received. Much of that, it says, has come from Gulf countries. Saila Hennessy for VOA News, London.
A Kenyan court has found two Iranians guilty of possessing explosives, allegedly for use in bomb attacks on Western and Israeli targets. Ahmad Mohammed and Saeed Mousavi were arrested in June 2012 and charged with possessing 15 kilograms of the explosive RDX. Both men had pleaded not guilty to the charges. They face up to 15 years in prison. In issuing today's judgment, Magistrate Karini Weriru praised the actions of the police in arresting the men and stopping a potential catastrophe. The two will be sentenced on Monday. Today marks 2 years since the death of Osama bin Laden, the terrorist blamed with masterminding the 9/11 attacks on the United States in 2001. Nearly 3,000 people were killed when al-Qaeda hijackers crashed two planes into the Twin Towers in New York and one into the Pentagon just outside Washington. A fourth plane went down in rural Pennsylvania after passengers fought with the hijackers. On May 2, 2011, U.S. forces tracked down and killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. President Obama decided not to release death photos of the al-Qaeda leader, saying the graphic images would create a national security risk and could incite violence. However, Murtaza Haider with Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada, has written an article saying bin Laden is now more fatal in death than he was alive. He writes, his life epitomized violence, but his death proved more fatal for others, end quote. We asked Mr. Haider to explain.
The point I'm trying to make is that at the time of his death, it was conveyed that the world will be a safer place after his death. And the point I'm making is that his death is irrelevant to what is going on in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, or Yemen, or for that matter. He had become irrelevant to the not only the militant movement, but more importantly, to the development of people in these Asia, in these regions. And therefore, after his death, one could see that the militancy took off in Pakistan, not as a result of his death, but in spite of his death. And that's the point I'm trying to make, that by having him eliminated, we did not make at least Pakistan and Afghanistan a safer place.
Why is that? Everybody thought it was going to make such a big difference.
Well, I think nobody thought. There was a Pew Research Center poll done in 25 countries, including the United States. And interestingly, fewer than 9% Americans thought that there will be a decline in violence now that Osama has been killed. It was not as... So I think policymakers, those who were political leaders, were of the view that this would result in a peaceful world and as if Osama was controlling the movement. But I think the masses, even in the United States, let alone in Pakistan, felt that Osama or anyone had any control of, over this militancy. It has become more atomized. It has become more retail, where bands of militants have grouped together, and they may see him in his death or in his life as their leader, but it has no practical implications. They go around doing their work without any central command and control system.
Why do you think this militancy has expanded? Are we doing something wrong?
Globally, there are several reasons. I think in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, what we are doing wrong is the continued American and NATO presence. As soon as we have the NATO troops withdrawn, and as soon as we have the Afghan and the Pakistani forces take control of the security situation, I, for one, expect that there will be a decline, not an elimination, but a decline in militancy, because the very presence of NATO forces provide the impetus and the soft support amongst non-militants for militancy in these regions. So the very first thing we have to do is to ensure that NATO and other foreign agents, services, militias, and armies are withdrawn from these regions, because that is being used as the primary rallying cry for militancy in these regions.
How about some other regions like the Middle East or North Africa?
Well, North Africa, again, these are different situations. It varies by country. There were dictators who were in command of these places, some of, like Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, for over three decades by American support. And therefore, whatever Hosni Mubarak or his regime did wrong, it was attributed as if Americans were doing it wrong. Same is the case with the Saudis. I mean, the regime is in place because of the American support. Anything that the regime does wrong is perceived as if the Americans are doing wrong. So you really have to cut the ties with these dictatorial, non-representative regimes. Some of them are fiefdoms, some of them are non-democratic. Actually, all of them are non-democratic entities that enjoy the support of the Western world, and the masses retaliate against them. And whoever supports these non-democratic regimes, in this particular case, in Saudi Arabia, it's the United States. In Egypt, it had been the United States. And then they associate the American Americans with the regime, and hence the retaliation and the anger against the American people. So what needs to be done is the fair and honest attempt to promote democracy, so that one can go against these militants, because even though they are opposing, they do not have a development agenda. They do not have a human rights agenda. These are militants, these are bandits, and they have murderous ideologies. But that could only be tackled by more openness, fairness, and free and fair electoral processes, where we do not play favorites and allow the people to elect their governments.
Murtaza Haider with Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada. You can read his article online. It's titled, Osama Bin Laden, More Fatal in Death. Reaction has been cautious in Israel and the Palestinian territories to the Arab League announcement that it supports the idea of using land swaps to negotiate future Israeli-Palestinian borders as part of a Middle East peace agreement. Arab ministers announced the position after a meeting in Washington Tuesday. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials expressed mixed reactions to the Arab League announcement that it would accept what it called minor and comparable land swaps to encourage the stalled Mideast peace negotiations. Israel's head negotiator for the talks, Justice Minister Tzipi Livni, called it positive news that sent a message to the Israeli public. She says we need to return to the negotiating table as soon as possible, and we certainly welcome the message from the Arab League. Israeli opposition leaders also expressed support for the proposal. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's response was more reserved. He told senior officials Wednesday that the root of the conflict is not territory, but rather the Palestinian unwillingness to recognize the state of Israel. The Palestinians' chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, said the Arab League announcement contained nothing new. In a statement, he said it represented the official Palestinian position, as was summarized Tuesday by the head of the Arab League delegation, Qatar's Prime Minister Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim Al Thani.
Agreement should be based on the two-state solution, on the basis of the 4th of June 1967 line, with the possible of comparable and mutual agreed minor swap of the land.
The statement underscores the position of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas that any negotiations should begin from the borders that existed before the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says those borders are not defensible for his country. The Israeli-Palestinian talks have been stalled for several years. The Palestinians say they could only resume if Israel stops construction of Jewish settlements in Palestinian territories and releases all political prisoners. The Israelis say the Palestinians should return to the negotiating table without preconditions. A political analyst with the Al Monitor website, Akiva Eldar, says nevertheless the Arab League statement gives hope for a new approach to the conflict.
The statement of the Arab League by the Qatari Prime Minister is a clear indication that the Arab League is involved in the peace process and that there is a hope for a new American strategy that looks at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in a kind of a regional perspective.
The head of East Jerusalem's International Peace Cooperation Center, Rami Nasrallah, agreed to a degree.
This is accepting principle which was discussed before. It's been agreed now by the Arab countries. I think this is a good start, if it's not a breakthrough.
Eldar explains a reason for Mr. Netanyahu's measured response.
For him, the fact that the Arab League has agreed to a territorial swap doesn't mean anything because he doesn't see the 67 lines as a basis for the swap.
Eldar notes that nearly 500,000 Israeli settlers now live in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. It would be difficult for any Israeli government to displace those living in the major settlements. And he says that since the Israeli elections in January, parties representing Jewish settlers and others who oppose giving up the Palestinian territories have become important partners in Mr. Netanyahu's coalition government. Analyst Nasrallah says the Arab League announcement could eventually help the peace process because it could give it legitimacy and allow the Arab world to be part of any solution.
Establishing a normal diplomatic relation between Israel and the Arab state, this is something important which could build the trust after reaching permanent status agreement.
Nevertheless, both experts agree that the main obstacles to resuming the peace talks are the positions of the Israeli and Palestinian negotiators, and they say these will have to change before any real progress can be made. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Freedom House, an independent watchdog dedicated to expanding freedom around the world, has released its annual report on global press freedom ahead of World Press Freedom Day on Friday. For VOA Television, Carla Babb tells us media and press freedom have declined in several areas across the globe.
Just one out of six people across the globe enjoyed a free press last year. Freedom House President David Kramer says the global decline in press freedom is a huge concern.
Free press is critical to any country's democratic development. It acts as a check and balance. It acts as a check on corruption. It promotes transparency. It promotes good government. And so a free press is indispensable.
The report says the percentage of people enjoying a free media environment fell to its lowest point in more than a decade due to the repression by authoritarian regimes, political instability, and threats from radical Islamists. Mansoor Ali is a reporter in the tribal areas of Pakistan, one of 64 nations the group says is unfree for media.
Security is the foremost problem because just 2 days ago, my colleague was injured in a suicide attack and another one was killed.
Mali, once Africa's freest media environment, suffered the year's biggest decline in press freedom. It slid from a free press nation to one of 70 partly free countries, following a military coup and the capture of its northern half by Islamist militants. In Europe, Greece also slid into the partly free category. Its economic troubles led to widespread staff cuts in the media and closures. In the Middle East, Libya and Tunisia retained gains in press freedom won during the Arab Spring revolts. But in Egypt, the media environment declined and is now described as unfree. Freedom House's Karin Karlikar says many factors are behind Egypt's decline.
Partly it was the new constitution, which was worrying in terms of the provisions for freedom of expression, the polarization in the media following the president's election, and the very high levels of attacks and harassment of journalists, particularly by Islamist groups.
Despite the declines, the report noted improvement in some countries, including Burma.
compared to where it was 2 years ago, it's been a huge improvement. And so in that regard, I would say it is sort of a model for other very repressive governments.
Freedom House plans to continue highlighting those countries that restrict press freedom until the media are free everywhere. But after the latest report, there's a long road ahead. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.